discuss is methodology in thinking. Okay? Now, all ideas, concepts, theories, definitions are all abstracting from a certain subject that you have in front of you. You have a subject, and you abstract certain ideas. Okay? The mind will naturally do this. In other words, most people will give interpretations or give causes of why things happen. You got a cold? Why'd you get a cold? Because you didn't wear your galoshes. You know? So the thing is that everybody thinks in terms of causes, and they give reasons or principles or concepts for the different things, okay, for the different phenomena that they're looking at. The difference between them and the scientist is the scientist works on perfecting that part of the mind to be able to clarify the definitions. Do is to start, do that in this group, for this class. How? Very simple. King Solomon said that the proverbs are for beginners. What are the proverbs? Proverb is a statement of a certain fact about life, right? And then we abstract the concept or idea of how it really works. That's really what we're doing. We're doing the same thing that any theorist in physics, math, or any other science does. We're doing it about life. We just have a different subject. But however, we have to do the same thing, where we see the facts, and then we abstract the concept. The same thing if we want to know how God operates. So we read the Chumash, and it's not just to remember this or that story. It's to abstract the concept of how God operates in certain situations and how He relates to us in different situations. So therefore, this method becomes very, very important for us if we're going to study through Torah and to get the ideas of what God wants to get across to us. So therefore, this method of thinking becomes very important, and it becomes very important to be precise in this so you shouldn't make any mistakes, because any mistakes means a mistake about God. Mistake in ethics, so then you're going to run your life in an incorrect manner. Therefore, by definition, you'll have to fail. What I propose for this class is that every week we will give a proverb. And that'll be for homework. And during the week, you'll work on it. And then you will come back to class, give over what you say, and we'll try to guide you either way you see it or where you're making mistakes, and slowly but surely to learn how to define the proverbs. And from there, build up to other areas in Torah to do the same thing, but first to learn the method. With the proverb, I'd just like to give you one starting point. When you're analyzing a proverb, always start with your questions. Even if you can't answer the questions, you should be trained to ask the questions, because the question is the guide. If you just jump to answers like, why, what's forcing you to go that way? So therefore, always start with the questions, and let your questions be your guide. If you ask one question, somebody asks another question, sometimes to guide you in different ways. So as many questions as is possible to see, that should be the start. And even if you don't have answers, if you just learn to question, that's also an important point. But you must have the guide, and the guide is the questions. So always look for any type of inconsistency or any type of thing that is not clear. Okay? The proverb that we're going to do is in chapter 10, verse 6 in Proverbs. And the proverb is a blessing to the head of a righteous man, and the mouth of the wicked hides or conceals violence. Is that there are different commentaries on the different verses. And the reason is the way they translate the verse. You see? Now, I'm reading in English in one particular way. Somebody might put the syntax or some other thing or a translation slightly different, which means it would have a whole different proverb. It maybe will come the value is if you know Hebrew, and then you start learning how to read the Hebrew, and then from the different commentaries, learn how to look at it from different angles. So that would be another analysis, which you don't have if you don't have the Hebrew. Okay? So all we're doing is taking the proverb. I have translated it. If you knew the Hebrew, then there would be another discussion of how to formulate the proverb to begin with. That also becomes an analysis. You see? So, but the thing is that without Hebrew, we'll just have the proverbs. Official, if a person can learn Hebrew and go back to the original text, there's a benefit in that. To do your homework in this area, you should not try to force answers. You should allow what comes to the mind naturally, the questions or insights, whatever it is, you are taking steps. Just enjoy the process. If you try to find answers, you're going to force yourself to take answers that you might have to skip steps to get the answer. That's harming you because you're skipping steps. You're training yourself to skip steps. Therefore, don't push any answer. Just allow the natural mind to take its steps, whether it's a question or an insight, a partial answer, an answer that you yourself disagree with, that's also fine. Whatever the mind, just enjoy it. Don't look for answers. Let the answers come. And just allow yourself to think about the statement that we gave and how you view it. It makes no difference right or wrong. Just enjoy the process. Okay? The possibility is, we're talking about blessing to the head of a righteous man, and the mouth of the wicked hides violence. Okay? Now, Doug wants to say that the possibility of blessing to the head of the righteous means that the righteous will receive blessing from others, right? And the mouth of the wicked hides violence. And they're dealing with others, even though they say one thing, but their intent is another. Artist, right? He says nice things, but however, he has intent to harm you. Okay? Now, what is the connection between the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse? They seem to have different subjects. That's because the first half is talking about that the result of living a righteous life is you will get blessings from other people. By blessing, the means, the way you're translating blessing now is that you'll be praised. Okay? The people will praise the righteous for his righteous acts. But however, the second half is saying that even though the wicked talk nice, like a con artist, he speaks very nicely to you, but he really, his intent is to harm you. So therefore, the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse have nothing to do with each other. In a problem like this, there are two approaches. One approach is either you're totally wrong and you might as well start off on a new approach of the verse, or it is possible that you have to clarify or maybe change part of the verse. You understand? In other words, like you gave two different subjects. First half has one, the second half has another. Maybe you could work it out. You could keep one subject and not the other. Or maybe through a certain twist of understanding, the way you understand it, you could bring them together into one subject. In other words, just because you have a question doesn't mean your total approach is wrong. It means either it's totally wrong. A question could either mean that what you're saying is totally wrong, and therefore you have to look for a new approach altogether. Or sometimes you can subdivide or work it out. We'll see how it works as we go along, the exact way that we operate. But the thing is, sometimes it could be you could fix up the whole thing and keep part of it. That that he harms others. That could be a con artist. He sells you something that really is not good. So therefore, he's harming you. It doesn't mean violence physical. It doesn't necessarily have to mean physical violence, even though it could mean physical violence, that he's hiding a way of harming you, inviting you someplace to harm you physically. It's any type of harm, whether it's monetary harm or physical harm. It's some type of harm. What I'm trying to discuss now is what does it mean to the head of a righteous man? What does it mean to the head of? Your own answers, then you should go back and check the answers by seeing if you can formulate questions. The Meiri, a medieval interpreter of Talmud and parts of Tanakh, of the Torah, of the written Torah, so he says that the only test for these ideas is questions. And you should question a subject. It should look as if your desire is to break it down, even though your desire should not be to break it down, but your desire is just to search for truth. And therefore, you must question it to make sure that you're getting the correct interpretation. The correct interpretation should not be able, there should be no questions left when you finish with your interpretation. So I'm basically saying is that the subject has to do with the benefits, like a blessing is a benefit. In other words, it's a benefit to the righteous, how he thinks, right? And it's a harm to the wicked, right, of the way he operates. Is that correct? There are two steps in analyzing Proverbs. The first step in analyzing Proverbs is to try to understand the verse itself. Later on, once you have clarity in the verse, then there's another check, and that is, does this work in the physical world? Does it actually happen in the physical world? That's a second type of question that you would have. But right now we're dealing only with the analysis of the verse and not the reality outside whether it does happen or not. That will come later once we've clarified the verse. The second half does not talk about the wicked, but the mouth of the wicked. We're not talking about the wicked. In other words, what state they're in, whether a good state or a bad state. We're talking, the subject is the mouth of the wicked. That's where you run into trouble between the first half and the second half. You see? In other words, the first half seems to be talking about, according to you, is that there's some benefit in the way he thinks. Right? There's some benefit in the way the righteous thinks. Okay? So then you want to say so then based on that, you want to interpret the second half. You say, but the words of the second half is not saying that. You see? Right? Okay. I'd like to explain a little bit about this. When you run into a problem where the first half and the second half does not fit at all, then what you're really asking, when you ask the question, what does the first half have to do with the second half? What you're really asking is, what is the subject matter? Now, what's going to happen is, since you're dealing with two statements, one statement should have one subject matter, and the other statement should have another subject matter. That's the problem. In other words, according to Doug, the first statement is that other people will bless the righteous. They'll be accepted and recognized by other people. The second half, the subject again, is that a con artist, like we said before. According to Kim, a blessing to the head of the righteous is that we're talking about his state of mind. But again, the second half is only talking about a con artist. So in both cases, we have two subject matters. And somehow we can't work out what the subject of the whole verse is. So far, is that we're still stuck on what one half has to do with the other half, and you're trying to fit the second half into the first half. What if we tried the second half, that subject, and see if that could fit into, somehow the first part could fit into the second half subject, to change the subject as of yet, of the second half. And we're still saying that the mouth of the wicked hides violence, means that we're talking about a con artist. Mainly that he says one thing, but his motive is to harm you. Okay? That's still the subject of the second half. Question is, can that subject somehow fit into the first half? The question is the mouth of the wicked hides violence, or even a con artist, saying a con artist, is the description. But the question is what is the subject of this description? Mouth is secrets. In other words, the wicked, they keep secrets, right? That's what the subject of the second half is, the secrets. That he says one thing, but he has in mind another, and he keeps the secrets of other what his real motive is. To the head of a righteous man, we are talking about a secret that a righteous man also keeps secrets. Okay? But the secrets that a righteous man keeps is for the benefit of others. For instance, sometimes he'll keep a secret that he'll know because it could hurt you, it could do harm to you. Or sometimes there's some knowledge that you're not ready for, and he might not give you that knowledge because it'll harm you. He has secrets too. But however, his secrets is a blessing, meaning that it's a benefit to everybody concerned, because his secrets are a benefit. So the subject is really secrets of both halves. This verse is the first half was too vague, and the ways we translate it, even though possible, in and of itself, would have fit in well. But however, they did not work out well with the second half. So therefore, what we did is we took the subject of the second half and see if that subject could fit in to the words, not by changing words. Now, the head of a righteous man, to the head of a righteous man, could definitely mean in his head, what's in his head. And since the subject matter is secrets, it means that the righteous man also has secrets in his head. But the secrets that he keeps is a blessing, meaning that it's a benefit for him to keep these secrets. And now the words fit in also. The words of a blessing to the head of a righteous man fits in. But the reason why we have, what forced us to explain it, was the original question of what does one subject have to do with the other of the two halves. We have to have one subject to the two halves. And so therefore we got to the interpretation via the second half of the verse. Distinction, but it is always in one subject. Here the subject is secrets. And so the two halves of the verse are dealing with the righteous and the wicked. And so how there are two ways of handling secrets. And to the head of, is it's a benefit, that which is to the head, in other words, which is in the head of the righteous, which is in the head. It's a benefit, translating a blessing as meaning a benefit. And that a benefit to the head over here means what's in his head. First half, it could come out many different interpretations. Some might even be closer to the word, possible. But however, because of the second half, which is so clear of what the subject is, that it has to be, the first half has to be, that it is a benefit to the head, meaning what's in the secrets that are in the head of the righteous man. It has to be that way. Questions, you see? The key is to find the question that's a guide. Then all the other questions will be answered when you finish the analysis. But the main thing is to get in this verse, the key was, what is the subject matter? That was the key guide. Okay? So you must have a lot of questions, but a lot of questions only show that you don't know what it's talking about. Then how you find the key to guide you. In every verse, it's different. 10, again, in Mishlei, and it's verse 4, and it says, a poor person makes a fraudulent weight, while the hand of the diligent becomes wealthy. By a fraudulent weight, it means they used to measure a pound, they used to have these weights, and if he would make the pound stone little less than a pound, that's the way you would cheat. Okay? So a poor person makes a fraudulent way, while the hand of the diligent becomes wealthy. That's homework for next week.
These are Kim's questions on the proverb.
A poor person makes a fraudulent way, while the hand of the diligent becomes wealthy. I'm wondering if the person is poor because they make a fraudulent way, or if they're just a poor person and this is something that they do.
And
it says they make a fraudulent weight, but it doesn't say they necessarily used it. It's just saying that's how they spend their time.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay. The questions that I had were, what is the person poor in? Are we talking about monetary wealth, or are we talking about something else? When it says a diligent becomes wealthy, wealthy in what? I had difficulty trying to determine what the subject of the verse was, because the statement a poor person makes a fraudulent weight gave an implication to me that poor people are always dishonest, and that didn't seem like it was true in the real world, so I was having difficulty with the juxtaposition.
The question that Doug asked, what does poor person mean, poor in what? There are always the two levels in interpreting Proverbs. One is on the literal level, and two on the metaphorical level. We should always try to interpret it first on the literal level. If we have a proof that it's literally impossible to be so, if we have such questions to show that it's impossible to have any meaning on the literal sense, it totally contradicts reality totally, then we must interpret it on the metaphorical sense. So we should always start on the literal sense. So therefore, we're going to take the proverb, a poor person, poor always means monetarily. Right. The second question, which Doug asked, was a poor person makes a fraudulent weight, is, he says, not all poor people do this. This seems to be universal. And he's asking the question that not all poor people do this. Is that correct? I was already asked. I would like to add one more. And that is that poor and diligent have nothing to do with each other. They're not opposites. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what is the subject of the proverb? Okay? I'd like to first take Doug's question about poor... that not all poor people, not all poor people are crooks. Now the thing is that when there's two types of questions that you have on Proverbs. One is the verse itself doesn't make sense, and since the proverb must be applicable to everyday life, so sometimes the question is like Doug's question is that it doesn't work. You're making a universal statement that poor people make fraudulent weights, and that is not true. Not all poor people are crooks. So the thing is therefore because of that, we must say that King Solomon, his style was to write it universally, but however, he must have realized that fact too. So therefore, he realized you would question it, and therefore you would subdivide. Okay? You would say that he must be poor, right? There's a certain type of poverty, you see, that will cause a person to be fraudulent or crooked. Okay? Now the question is, what type of poverty and what type of poor person, like you said, like you asked the question also, that a poor person doesn't cause you to be, you know, or like Kim asked, is it the poor person that makes you poor, or is it the poverty, you know what I mean, makes you poor and then you become a crook? So the thing is that what I really think what's happening here is that he is poor because of something within him, and therefore he becomes a crook, you see? Now the thing is, I also have a proof from the verse. What's the proof? Because we ask, what does the first half have to do with the second half? Therefore, we're asking, what's the subject? Now, if I ask you, what is the subject of the verse, what would you say?
if we can't talk about the subject, what are the two opposites that we're dealing with? In other words, sometimes before we could find the subject of the two opposites, we have to find the two opposites. So let's find the two opposites first before we actually get the subject. What's the two opposites that we're dealing with? It can't be poor and diligent. That's impossible. True. You're saying that one is honest and one is dishonest. That happens to be true. But the question is, why is the man poor? Or not all poor people are going to steal. So therefore, there must be something about this poor person that will make him steal, right? The question is, what is about this person that will make him steal? And I think the answer lies in the proverb itself. The person is poor by virtue of his laziness, that King Solomon is saying will lead to a false type of a fraudulent person or a crooked person. Is there, in other words, why isn't it possible that a lazy person could be honest? I understand I'm lazy, so I'm poor, but I might still have some integrity. Where does King Solomon say, where does he get that laziness is a cause to lose your integrity and to become crooked? What is the quality in laziness? Take a case, okay? You tell your child that they should go to school, get good marks. They need it, right? And the child is lazy about getting the marks. Okay? Now, what's the difference between you and the child? Is that you see the consequences and they don't. So what don't they have? They're lacking.
That's correct.
What they're lacking is truth, reality. They don't see the truth of reality. While you do. So the thing is, a person is lazy because he doesn't see the harm. He doesn't see the truth of the consequences of his actions. In other words, if your child would see a truck coming at him at 70 miles an hour, he would not be lazy. He'd move out of the way real fast. You see? So the thing is in other words, your child is not crazy. I mean, there are people that are, but I mean, the thing is that we're talking about a normal person that's lazy is because they don't see the benefit. They don't see in reality that anything is going to happen to them. They're losing out on truth. So therefore, it is true that sometimes a person is driven because of their emotions. Okay? But that is not what King Solomon is talking about. That's a different type of problem. And we have to wait for another verse to discuss these people that are just driven emotionally. But what King Solomon is defining as diligent and lazy, in other words, now we could define the subject. The subject is the lazy and diligent measures a person's relationship to reality. If he sees the truth about a certain situation, once he sees that there's no way he's not going to do it, if it's real to him, if that is just like a truck is coming at you, that's real to you, so then he has to do it. While the lazy person doesn't see that reality, and therefore he doesn't bother doing anything about it. Antidote to laziness is what?
Exactly.
Along with the analysis, there should be no questions left. If there's any question left, then that means there is still a problem and a further investigation is necessary. This is that the diligent are not always wealthy, and sometimes a lazy person is wealthy. Okay? So the question is that the statement is not totally universal. And with that, you have to understand the framework in which the book of Proverbs is written. The book of Proverbs cannot, if you're ignorant of what was going to happen on Mount St. Helens, and Mount St. Helens blew, and you were hurt, that's not your fault. It's out of your realm. There's no way of knowing. There is no way of knowing. So therefore, yes, we are not saying
that Proverbs will give you control of the laws of nature. Proverbs will not give you control over whole societies. I mean, this is run by governments. This is out of your hand. What Proverbs can undo is any mistake that you personally can make in any given situation. But even if you don't make any mistakes, that doesn't guarantee 100%, but it will guarantee 95%. In most situations, you will be successful. But however, there's sometimes things that are out of your hands, and there's nothing you can do about. Once you're in a situation that there's nothing you can do about, then you just have to accept these are the facts. There's nothing I can do about it. That also has to be analyzed when it's your fault and when it's not your fault. Question of the diligent, not all diligent, when we're talking about diligent, we're talking about a person that knows the life of Proverbs. He lives the life of Proverbs. If he is not successful and it's not due to him, that's not in the hands of Proverbs. That's different. That might be a different book in the Torah, how to deal with these things and how to relate to these things. But the book of Proverbs is only to undo your error in any given situation. Memory of the righteous. By the memory, I mean like when the righteous die and you remember them, like memory and memorial. Okay? So the memory of the righteous is for a blessing, and the name of the wicked will rot. Another proverb for homework. And the second proverb is, by the way, it's verse 11, this one in chapter 10. The source of life is the mouth of the righteous, and the mouth of the wicked conceals or hides violence. Okay, this week we're going over the proverb of the memory of the righteous is for blessing and the name of the wicked will rot. And the first thing that we'd like is some questions. What is a blessing, and to whom is the blessing? So it says the memory of the righteous is for a blessing, so who is the blessing for? Why by the righteous do they use memory, and by the wicked they use name, the memory of the righteous, and the name of the wicked? Why do they change from memory to name? And there are some questions which sometimes we might not have an answer to. I mean, it's possible we will get the answer to this. And the memory, difference between memory and name, it could be a literary difference, just to make it sound nice, not to have the same word, to repeat the same word. But the thing is that the main problem is we have to find the question that leads to the essential idea, you see? So that it's a guide. The question has to be a guide. Then all the other questions that we ask will either fall in place or we'll have to work out later. But we shouldn't sit down to answer each and every question. What we should try to search for is the essential idea, and that we need the question to guide us. The name of the wicked will rot. I mean, we know all the famous wicked people that have existed. We still know them. I mean, it's a fact. We know them. None of them rotted. The name is still remembered. How does a name rot? You know, a body rots, but a name doesn't. So, I mean, these things still exist. I mean, their names and the history of these people still exist. So what is he talking about? What does he mean? One aspect that we want to say is that we're talking about that it's after the death. Somehow we're talking about when the righteous die and the wicked die, somehow, that's the subject that we're talking about. Exactly how we're dealing with it, we're still not clear on that. I think, should we get involved in what is righteous and what is wicked? And the thing is, you have to let your question be your guide. Because the thing is that if the verse is not pointing to any information about righteous or wicked, so then you can accept your old definition of righteous or wicked, and you can't get anything from the verse, unless somehow the verse contradicts that. Or if you have a definition of righteous and wicked from another part of Proverbs, or even from another part of Torah, and you find that this verse contradicts it, so then the contradiction will help guide you to a concept. But if you really have no question to guide you, so then you have to accept the old definition of wicked and righteous, and because the verse will probably not help you in any way to guide you, unless there's a contradiction or some question to guide you. Two ways of, in other words, the verse is talking about the memory of the people, right? In other words, a righteous person or a wicked person. Now, the thing is, when you're talking about, you're looking back at what a person did or what a person didn't do, shouldn't we look at the actions of the people? In other words, they are righteous people. I mean, even the Torah sometimes mentions an area where one of the righteous people made an error, right? Made a mistake. So, and sometimes, what? Right? And sometimes a wicked person, you could learn something from a wicked person. Let's say, for instance, we would learn from Hitler about a strategy of war called the Blitzkrieg. Now, if I'm going to war just because Hitler created it, that doesn't mean I shouldn't use it. I mean, it would be if I was fighting a just war, and I needed this to win the war, then I would definitely use it. You see? In fact, they say by King David, when King Saul died in the war, it says King David taught his soldiers about shooting bows and arrows. Why? Because there was a new strategy of war that the enemy used against Saul, and somehow in shooting bows and arrows. There's something new. I don't have exactly. And immediately King David took that and taught his army that new strategy, which he took from the enemy. So therefore, I mean, there are things that you could learn from wicked and so-called strategy of certain sorts. Maybe you can't learn good and evil from them, you know, or you can know what not to do when you define evil. But the thing is you could, there's certain actions. And the question is, why does it relate to the person, right, instead of the actions? You should remember the righteous actions, and you should remember the wicked actions should rot. Should not rot altogether, because you should remember the actions of the wicked and see why it is evil, so to know what not to do. You should understand why is this considered evil. Once you understand why it's considered evil, then you know why not to do it. What you have to say is definitely talking about a righteous person and a wicked person. That's the verse is saying. Our question is it should have been talking about a righteous action and wicked action. I want to say that perhaps the verse is telling us that, like many times, we see things and we remember things in a better light than it actually was, and the proof of that is many times we go back to places that we remember with great fondness and we don't see it the same way when we come back. Remember, there were weaknesses there. Now, the question is, if that's what the verse is talking about, so then that would be a difficulty, because the verse should try to undo these false views. Because we're trying to find reality, and the mind plays tricks on us and makes us see the world incorrectly. So the verse should not be advocating this idea, But the verse should be trying to undo this type of idea, not advocating this idea. Now, Kim wanted to defend it by saying that, but still in all, it is a positive view of life, and therefore we should advocate a positive view of life. And if we have a therefore that's what King Solomon is advocating, a positive view of life. Trying to look at life in actual, not in a positive or negative way, but just to define actually what is reality. Okay? Say that maybe the verse is talking about that when a person looks at how people are going to look at them after life, you see, so then the way they look at them after life, so it will make her want to do the right to speak, so she should be remembered in a positive manner, while the wicked will not be remembered in a positive manner, and so therefore this would push a person to live the correct life. Altogether, what does a verse of Mishlei do? Does a verse of Mishlei tell us what does happen or what should happen? Okay? When it tells us what does happen, so that we should realize to be careful of what does happen. Or it tells us what to do. But the result of the verse must be something that I could deal with, that helps me deal with life. Sometimes dealing with life, you tell me a certain reality that I should do. Then sometimes you tell me a certain reality to be aware of the reality. That's also a lesson, so I should be able to deal with it. Just the knowledge of the reality. We'll have to see different verses, but different verses work in different ways. This is doing, that we'll have to see when we get through with the analysis. Possibility that was given for the interpretation of the verse was that a person will want to be good so that their name should be remembered after they die in a good life. Now the question is this a good motive for being good? Someone is interpreting the memory of the righteous is for blessing, by the word blessing, we mean that people will remember the righteous in a good light, in a nice light, so that they would want to be like the righteous and people will remember them. Blessing to the people that hear the stories of the righteous, the future generations. Blessing here in the verse is not for the future generation. It's talking about that the righteous will be remembered as a great thing, as a great benefit, as a good thing. That is what the word blessing means. Now that person was a blessing. That the person was a blessing, and then since he's remembered as a blessing and every human being wants to be remembered as a blessing, instead of just a feeling like a rot, so therefore this would be a motive for getting people to do the right thing. Is that a good motive for being righteous? The question is like this. What is the best motive for being righteous? Is the best motive for being righteous this motive? Because the people, so that you should have a good name, that you should be remembered by other people? Or is there inherently a benefit in being righteous? Now, we know that there's inherently a benefit in being righteous, and that's why you should be righteous. You see? So the question is, would they advocate that you should be righteous so that people will remember you as a righteous person? Person that decides to be righteous because he hears all the stories of the righteous and how nice people speak about them. And when they speak about the wicked, they speak in a very degrading way. So when he hears these stories, therefore he desires to be righteous. You see, that's what makes them want to be righteous. That the memory of the righteous is a blessing is people praise by blessing here, according to Kim's interpretation, then blessing over here means to praise the righteous. What is the benefit of praising the righteous after they're dead? And what is the benefit of making the names of the wicked look like rot? What is the benefit? So the benefit is for future generations, so that they should be remembered. They should be remembered as a... they want to be remembered as a righteous person after that. That's an emotional thing. It's like an ego thing. So that will be a motive to get future generations to do the right thing. You see? While when you degrade the wicked, so future generations don't want to identify with the wicked because everybody looks down on them. So therefore, that becomes the motive for a person to be good and to turn away from evil. Okay? But we ask the question, is that a good motive for being righteous? Isn't the reason that you should be righteous? Because inherently we could show that being righteous is a benefit for the human being. It's inherently a good. Not just for after I die, I'll be remembered by others. You see? But after they're dead, if I say that a righteous guy was a righteous guy, that doesn't benefit him anymore. He's dead. Right? So it can only benefit other people. Now, how could it benefit other people? Only by virtue of the fact that they'll want to identify with him, and that other people should praise them. That they should be praised by other people. Just like when they hear the righteous is being praised, so they're drawn to that thing which they will always be praised. So they'll also be praised. They want that praise. And that they will be praised after death. So therefore, you're saying that the verse is saying that this is a good reason for a person to be righteous. In other words, we advocate telling stories of the righteous and degrading the wicked for one purpose, so that future generations should be good. Now, all I'm asking on that is that a good motive for being good? Isn't the correct motive for being good when you see inherently that being righteous is a good? The benefit to your life, it perfects the soul. You see what it does for you. You see clearly what it does for you. Well, what is this idea about after death? We're learning the verse now. We're saying that the motive for a person to be good is that they should be praised like the righteous, and they won't be degraded like the wicked. And the question is that a good motive for being righteous? Is it definitely and resounding no? That's not a good reason. I mean, either we have to find a new interpretation or somehow straighten out this old one. That's just what we did here. When you have a verse that you don't understand, you first formulate the question. The question is your guide, and then as soon as we had the question, you started giving possibilities. Now, the natural mind grabs at the closest possibility. So therefore, but that first possibility that you grasp is not always the right one. So then we start questioning it and analyzing it to test it out if it's really a good interpretation. Now, if it doesn't work, so then once the mind sees that it's wrong, then that leaves room for the mind to search for something new. But if it doesn't see the contradiction, it doesn't see it's wrong, then why shouldn't the mind accept the answer that they have? What's wrong with it? There's no reason for it to continue on to look for anything new. There's no reason for it unless they see that there's something wrong. And that's what's happening in our discussion. What's happening is that once you see the question, then your mind naturally starts looking for the possibility. And once you start looking for the possibility, then you have to question and test out the possibilities through questions to see if it really works. And there's two types of tests. One, does it fit into the verse? Like, for instance, the last possibility definitely fits into the verse. But however, our question is, it doesn't fit into the philosophy of Torah. You see? So therefore, that can't be an interpretation of the verse. Except anything, because somebody else says it so. The only thing that you accept is the verse, because that's the postulate. That's what we're starting with. That's what we're analyzing. We accept the verse. But then once we go into the analysis, the possibilities, I mean, it must be clear to the mind that the interpretation is correct. It's It's not just an acceptance of authority or another person for being polite. It must be clear to the mind. If it's not clear to the mind, then formulate the question. That you have to understand that Mishlei, a proverb, is written for the beginner. Okay? And there's no way that when you're starting and studying, is that you could have the correct motive for study. There's no way that it's impossible. The correct motive for study only comes via study itself. Because if you study correctly, then that itself changes the motive why you do it. But when you start out, you must start out with an incorrect motive. You have no choice. I mean, it has to be, in other words, let's say, for instance, we say the correct motive is a love of learning. Now, a love of learning can only come after you've learned a certain amount of years. Let's say the correct motive is because you see the good and the good that there is in living this life, the benefit that there is in living. You can't see that for years, the benefit. By studying all the throughout the Proverbs and throughout other areas of Torah, you start seeing the benefit, and then it becomes part of you, where it affects your very being, that you have the true motive. And this book, Proverbs, was written for the beginner. So what we're saying is that Kim's answer is really correct. That really you should tell stories of the righteous and build them up and degrade the name of the wicked, so that people should desire to do the correct action for the incorrect motive and get involved in study of Torah for the incorrect motive. Because the study of Torah itself will bring you to the correct motive. But you must start out with an incorrect motive. And since this book, Proverbs, was written for the beginner, so therefore this verse becomes a true verse for the beginner. Saying that you should tell stories of the righteous and for blessing. When you tell the story, you should tell all their good points. Don't point out the weaknesses. And when you talk about the wicked, don't point out the good. Don't show them the difference in actions and define the different actions. But make it for, to talk to about them in a wonderful, the righteous in a wonderful light and the wicked in a bad light, so that people, for people, let's put it this way, you should talk about it for people that are not involved in study yet, and this would get them involved because they want to be remembered as a righteous, so that would be a good motive, even though it's an incorrect motive, but it's a good motive to get them started. Then if they really get started and they really start working hard, then their motive will change after a certain amount of time of study. Involved in the world of study, then you'll go back to these stories of the righteous and the wicked and analyze the individual actions and see why this action of the righteous is good and what's the benefit and why the action of the wicked is not good. Or what actions, or if there is an action that is good, what I could learn from and what I cannot learn from. But that's already a person that's a thinker that is not drawn by these ordinary, like the emotions of pride and what people think of me, you see. But the beginning, when we're motivated by these emotions, so then we have to draw people in for it based on these emotions. The object really of this verse is education. And we educate beginners through stories and allow them to identify or to break identification with the hero of the story. You see, either to identify with the righteous or to break the identification with the wicked. So therefore, the way we're learning the verse, the verse is a method of education for beginners. The subject is education, right? And when you educate a person, it's important to have them identify with a good education, with the heroes of the good education, so they should want to imitate them and continue in that way, and to have them turn away from the wicked, you see? until later on. Then you could analyze the actions and show why and where the all the whys and wherefores of an action. But to begin with, the beginning education is to attract the student towards the true life and the beneficial life, and to turn them away from the life of pleasure and the harmful things of life. Is that when you see a lot of people that advocate the good through stories, it never leads to a life of study. It remains in that situation. It doesn't change. You see? The thing is, what the Torah is saying, this is good for a beginner to start, but they should not stay. In other words, in most other cases, if they are advocating a just system, I'm not so sure those systems are really just. That we'll have to see according to more illustrations in Proverbs. But however, the thing is that it remains, the motive remains only to identify with the good person. They never explain logically why that is the good life. We say that's only for beginners. But for later on, then there's a different type of education. But for the beginner, the education is through, you should help them identify with the righteous and break their identification with the wicked. The subject is education for beginners. That we gave for homework last time was verse 11, and the proverb words, the source of life is the mouth of the righteous, and the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. The source of life. What is the source of life? The source of life is, we'll translate, the source of life is in the mouth of the righteous. That'll make it a little clearer. What does it mean in the mouth of the righteous? It's in the righteous habit. What is in the mouth of the righteous? Second half of the verse, that the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, yes. What I wanted to say was that we had that verse prior to this, which says, in the mouth of the wicked hide violence. So Doug wants to say over there, we said that's talking about secrets, so maybe we could start here by saying we're also talking about secrets. Is that if they speak right, if you're talking about in the mouth of that they actually speak about righteousness, then it can't be secrets anymore if the first half is talking about speaking and not about secrets. And that they keep secrets, he says, the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, means that they speak with forked tongue. In other words, they say one thing when they mean another. But the subject was secret. Okay? That is what we said last time. That the subject was secret. And that they said one thing, but they were hiding another. Okay? But over here, you're going to have two problems. One of the first doesn't seem to be, is in the mouth of the righteous, seems to be that he's talking. What he's talking, he says openly talking. Doesn't talk about like before. And two, if you can interpret it like the first verse, then what's the difference between the first verse and this verse? You mean they're both saying the exact same thing? They're dealing with the exact same subject? Why should he repeat himself? It was just a few verses back. We have that idea already about secrets. So why should he repeat himself? The same words, but however, it can't have the same meaning because it just doesn't fit in. That when it says the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, in that statement lies two possibilities. One is the main thing is the concealing, namely the secret, or the main thing is what he is saying. Now in the last verse, based on the subject of the last verse and interpretation of the last verse, he was saying the essence is concealing violence, and what he says covers that up. He hides it. But the thing is, it is possible that in this verse, there's going to be what the mouth of the wicked says is going to be the essence of the verse. In other words, the actual speaking might be the essence of the verse. I think that's where it's going. So that you understand, in other words, you can have the same words And I just want to show you that we are not changing around any of the words, or we're not playing any games with words. It's just, where is the essence lie? In other words, sometimes in the same statement, there are different aspects, and he's using different aspects in different verses, and the verse itself has to guide you. Is that clear? From the questions that we have in this verse, it's going to force us to interpret that both sides of this verse is talking something about speaking. And now when he conceals violence, we're going to have to understand how that fits into the speaking. Before, the speaking had to fit into the concealing of violence. Okay? But however, we're not changing any words. We're just using the words and interpreting them as according to the way it was set up, the way King Solomon set it up in the verse.